Good morning, Lynn.
Good to have you.
Likewise.
Yeah, so yeah, I just was redoing some stuff on the website. Oh my gosh. And thank you so much, Joan. Joan, you are such a blessing to us, and I so appreciate you, the calm, gentle, the way that you read the course in the lessons is just it's a meditation in itself. I love it. So thank you, Joan. And so Bruce, how are you doing this morning? Let me just for the audience on the radio and everywhere else, you've got Lynn Johnson and Bruce Rawls, and we're at the House of the Rising Sun this morning. And the sun is almost rising here in Colorado, and I bet it's not rising yet for you in California, is it?
It's a little dark and rainy, which is good actually. So as far as dream aspects go, it's nice to get a little rain here. So
Yeah, it's probably yeah. I hear that it's pretty. It's a desert where parched and thirsty creatures come to die. Is that
yeah, I
for
think
you?
that would be an apt description, but I think that applies to even the most soggy regions of this abode. Our alleged residence here.
That
Yeah.
something? Yeah.
Yeah.
And how people
Yeah.
love it here too, and they're just so afraid of the thought of something else, that they want to cling so much to what they think we have. It's just crazy. What we think we have is so limited, so small. You
Yeah.
just don't know it till you start seeing it. So,
Exactly. Exactly.
yeah.
I like how somewhere I think in the text of A Course in Miracles it says, "The Course doesn't," and I'm paraphrasing as usual, "doesn't seek to deprive us of the little we think we have." But that just
Yeah.
which speaks just to what you're just saying is that that we think that there's still something here that is worth investing our identity in. Not that we should stop doing what we're doing, but to just look at our investment in the trying to make the outcome make us happy from some seemingly external thing, which never left the mind. All it is just a little switch in the mind that says, "Oh, other teacher."
Yeah. Well,
It's dim and dusty and covered with piles and piles of millennia of debris that covers that switch, and even our memory of that pile of debri, that
digging, digging. Well,
it seems like we have to dig to get to
we do
it,
have to dig, yeah. And it's I'm looking at this in chapter four, section one. Jesus says to us, "The ego has built a shabby and unsheltering home for you because it cannot build otherwise. Do not try to make this impoverished house stand. Its weakness is your strength. Only God can make a home that is worthy of his creations who have chosen to leave it empty by their own dispossession. Yet his home will stand forever and is ready for you when you choose to enter it. Of this you can be wholly certain, God is as incapable of creating the perishable as the ego is of making the eternal."
That's a wonderful paragraph, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we, I'm just watching how I'm now being a satirical proxy for the ego in my response here. It says, but the ego says, just to pay attention to what goes on in our mind typically, it says, "Oh, but I've got things to do. I've got things that I know are going to make me happy here in the world." And isn't it amusing to just watch that? And learn over time, gradually, because that's the only way that we'll usually do it. Is not too many instant enlightenment, spiritual career path trajectories out there. But we, slowly but surely, look at what's, the things that we think are challenging us, and or the things that we think that are enriching us, that seem to be outside ourselves, and realize, wait a minute. None of that has made any difference in this eternal being that is the shabby and unsheltering home for us, and this impoverished house. And but we keep trying to, glamorize the heck out of it. And I think of it as like, hiring an interior decorator for the dumpster that we've landed in, and instead of just asking somebody for a rope or climbing out on the debris, that pile of debris there.
love it. Yep. And actually, I see myself doing that all the time. So, not that I live in a dumpster, but I might as well because
Well,
everything I got is perishable. It's not going to last.
and not to diminish or dis use a contemporary slang, anything in this world, but to savor what we can truly benefit from, which is the forgiveness classroom that everything in this world represents for us, and to just look at it with incredible gratitude because it seems a right, as the course might say. Everything becomes an opportunity to remember that our brother and ourself has not left, the perfect oneness. Nothing happened. I have a an FAQ that might be good to read.
Oh yeah.
Should we jump in with another one of those?
Absolutely. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. And I think it ties into what we've been just talking about, that
They always do.
this. Inevitably, because that was the answers always kind of lead us back to that generalized awareness that the course is all about. So here's FAQ number 1020, if you want to look for that one, and I'll just read the question, which is very short, two sentences, or actually a sentence and a question. And this is from the FACIM Outreach.org, or Foundation for A Course in Miracles.org's outreach section, which is the frequently asked questions. And if you, it's actually quite, if you go to that, I'll read the full URL in case anybody wants to
I'm
type
going
it
to
in.
post it
It's
in the room so that people could.
okay, yeah.
The other thing
It's
too is when you're
FACI.
doing these, say what year they're from because they're listed by year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Let's see.
So this is
It's 2006.
2006. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was October 11th, 2006, I believe,
Okay.
according to the kind of the greenish stripe at the top. Okay. And so the full URL is facim.org/QA/questions/questions209.htm, if anybody wants to type all that in. Okay. So I'll read the question. And these are also good. Number 1020, at times I feel depressed and a bit fearful with the reality that this is all an illusion. I know it is my ego mind that is weighing me down, but this feeling can be very intense. What is going on? And the first paragraph of the four paragraph answer is, what is going on is a normal reaction when someone is told that everything they think about the world is wrong.
Sorry.
It
normal
is
to be told you're
hilarious.
totally insane.
Yeah, and it's no different than saying, excuse me, a little gentle tap on the shoulder from behind, says, excuse me, this thing that you're trying to glamorize, this is a ghetto. This is a mental ghetto. Not, again, not to d diminish or dissuade us from enjoying the things that come and go that seem to make us happy, and but and ultimately we're like a kid on December 26, playing with the boxes and hoping that the now litter of broken toys from the day before, there's going to be something left in the packaging, and we play with the packaging for the rest of the year, waiting for something magical to happen with the packaging, and not even realizing that the we never really opened the toys, and they never were broken. And the real fun stuff, anyway. Maybe the toys isn't such a good metaphor, but
I love it, yeah.
the reality is that, yeah, we never left. Nothing happened. We couldn't have possibly damaged that oneness. Okay, so I'll start that answer over again.
Okay.
What is going on? I tend to digress, have you noticed?
Oh, me too, so.
But then, isn't that what this world is? It's a massive digression from
That's
Paramahansa.
right. It's a song. It's called They Call Me the Great Digressor.
Is there really a song
Oh,
with it?
no, it's a great
Oh,
pretender.
okay. I was gonna say, yeah, it sounded like The Great Pretender, but that's a good parody. I like that. Okay, what is going on is a normal reaction when someone is told that everything they think about the world is wrong. And yes, that is funny. Seen from what we really are, the mind begins to suspect that if the world is not real, then neither is the body with which it has chosen to identify. Doubt thus enters the belief system that holds the world and the body together. And that can only mean trouble for the ego. Feeling attacked, it defends itself, thereby attacking the mind. The attack brings on guilt in the form of depression, fear, anxiety, and every other form of misery experienced by the body. And that depression, fear, and anxiety, also I think I would add to that, and it certainly fits, is doubt. And, you know, because we start to doubt, well, oh, it says doubt, yeah, doubt enters the belief system, right. The doubt that, that somehow this is going to work for us. And what came to mind as I was just reading that paragraph is that this classic Monty Python skit, and I'll find the URL and post it on the post that I make of our conversation this morning, I think it's El Magnifico and Janet, the hypnotist and his assistant from a classic Monty Python skit. And basically, he goes into a room in this skit, and there's a tenant of this high-rise flat that's starting to doubt that he's really there. And El Magnifico is a hypnotist. And so, you know, basically, this is a documentary about these new flats put up by hypnosis. And essentially what happens is he has to go in and perform remedial hypnosis every so often because the tenants start doubting that they're really there. And then and the building starts to waver and you know, totter back and forth.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And so then when it's kind of in almost in free fall, you know, he you see that, you know, the effect of his hypnosis and then they reverse the film and then the high rise building uprights itself and then it's still again. But oh, it's a great clip. It's a short little clip. I'll find it. But that's just it. You know, we're in this you know, high rise structure, this elaborate structures, not just a high rise, it's a whole cosmology, it's a whole universe that we've made up, and the hypnotist, this maladaptive hypnotist that we hired is the ego, and you know, it's our only employee on the payroll, even though it appears that we've hired all these other actors and actresses that we call the people of our lives, and they're just representatives for any time we're not feeling at peace. But the same cast, the exact same cast and crew, and all the choreographers and set designers and everything can serve a different purpose, which is that inner kindness teacher buried under that pile of rubble. If we just reach, you know, dig down, find that switch that glimmers patiently while we wait for us to find it and flick the switch. And once we do that, everything takes on a glow and a sparkle and a shine that says, oh, now I can be used for forgiveness. Now I can be used to look at my mind without condemnation, without judgment, and with the awareness that everything can serve that purpose. Everything can serve the function of reminding me that my mind projected this, and it can choose otherwise. I can choose against El Magnifico's high rise. Not that we don't still appear to live there, but we don't allow its waverings to bother us and its seismic rumblings to bring fear, depression, anxiety, and every other form of misery, as the head quote says. Do you want to read the next paragraph or comment on the first one?
Sure. Let me hear. Where all my things are moving around here. I kind of close a few windows. Oh, okay.
That's because El Magnifico is working on your computer too.
That's right. Yeah.
Like everyone else's.
Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking crazy thoughts here, and I don't know if you bought any tickets for this Powerball that went on this last week, but the Powerball was up to like what, $1.3 billion or more, or $1.5 billion, uh-huh. And you know, how many people, I mean, it went up like up and up and up on Saturday because so many people, I think they sold like $19 million worth of tickets here in Colorado alone on Saturday. Wow. So everybody was just frantic to, you know, not frantic, but, you know, thinking, oh, I can get a piece of that $1.5 billion or whatever. And I think maybe three people won. A lot of people won. A lot of people won $100,000 and such.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty big deal. But every single one of those people, and including me, if I would have, you know, I walked up and bought some tickets. If I would have won that, would I have been here sitting with you and talking with you today? I don't know. You know, would I think that my ship had come in and now my world was going to be all cool and I could, buy it? You know, here's my fantasy. I was fantasizing if I won any of that, I was going to buy a system for awakening together that we didn't have to be on Pal Talk. We could have our own thing and do you know, I was thinking I could do that for us. You know, these are my dreams. So, and they are just as ridiculous. That's just as ridiculous as if I was going to buy an island in the middle of the Caribbean and fence it off with mines. And you know, it doesn't matter what I think I was going to do with it. The whole idea was I was going to try to fix up this dumpster that I'm living in and make it a little more habitable for me, but it's never going to be habitable for the Holy Son of God, no matter how much you put into it or what you do, because we cannot limit ourselves to this limited of a existence. It's like we have concentrated, or I don't know if we've dumbed ourselves down to the point where we can live with this without too much stress, and so we're just kind of hanging on, or if we've, you know, if we're just numb to it, or or what the deal is. But I, like I said, I could even see myself thinking of fantasies and dreams of how I could change the, put on new wallpaper on my dumpster, and let's get a few of those Febreze things in here so it doesn't stink so bad. You know, I mean, that's really my thinking still after all these years. So, you know, I can't imagine if you have never been exposed to this course how this would, you know, get to you. But it will always bring about depression because you can't limit me like this. I can't be limited like this. It's painful.
You bring up a really good point, because the course doesn't bring about the depression. It's our decision for the ego that we stubbornly, we all do, and I'm, you know, raising my virtual hand, we all stubbornly, you know, refuse to relinquish our white knuckle grip on the ego's thought system, and that's what brings the depression. But that's the last thing the ego wants to admit, because that was basically tantamount to saying, I'm clinging to an idea, a tiny bad one, but it's an idea that somehow this world is going to work for me. I don't know how, but there's got to be some way that this is going to work for me. And the better way that Helen and Bill asked for, they discovered, and we're all discovering, that it's not about changing the world. It's about changing how we think about the world. But that's the last thing that we want to do. Usually we default and jump right back to get left to our own separate identity self devices, to the idea that somehow we can do it on our own. We can fix this up. We can make the prodigal dream work. And even though we don't want to acknowledge that it's a dream, you know, what do you mean where I live is put up by hypnosis? I mean, come on now. How dare you suggest that I'm living in a shabby hologram? You know, I've decorated it quite nicely. Thank you very much. You know, and we, you know, storm off in a huff. Right. But that's kind of basically what we do every time we, you know, get those little, you know, bursts of inspiration that give us the insight that things could be unimaginably better, not in a comparative way, but in terms of a reality that it's so dim and so distant and so piled over with other junk that we've forgotten that we even have that. I think that's where the forgotten song is such a wonderful, compelling, and inspiring part of the course, that it speaks to that. And lesson 182 in the workbook, that we're like little kids that we've adopted these seemingly sophisticated roles and all these things in our story that are, wow, I did this. And then when I turned 50, I did that. And then that happened. And then, oh, this was so cool. And, you know, and sure, you know, knock ourselves out. But ultimately, at the end of the day, at the end of the eternity, or ego seeming eternity, we still are left with that. Well, okay. And so what? Right.
Right. And then when am I going to get my prize?
Yeah.
No, I've done all this. When am I going to get my prize? You know,
where's that brass ring?
I
don't even know that there's a gold ring, but I just want to, you know, have the, you know, a little pause in the merry-go-round and have a brass ring if I don't get the gold ring, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I can ride the merry-go-round again. I mean, that's the whole purpose of winning the brass ring, right? So you can ride the merry-go-round for free again. And that's what we want to do. That's all we want to do is grab that brass ring so we can keep going on the merry-go-round.
And Artman Persa, Gary's teachers, Gary Renard's teachers, I think in one of his books mentioned that it's the not so merry-go-round, which I thought was a great reminder. Yes. Should we jump back to the second part?
Okay, so I'll read the next paragraph. What is depressing is not the fact that the world is an illusion, but the belief that it is real. The problem begins when the mind chooses the separation, causing it to split into a wrong mind that believes the separation is real, and a right mind that knows it is not. The wrong mind, ego, defends and maintains its choice by identifying with the body and making the world real. The mind then becomes the body in its right mind that knows that it is... Wait a minute. Where did I go here?
Yeah, back up to the mind then. I think you just skipped a line there.
Okay, yeah, I did. The mind then becomes the body in its experience of itself and feels intensely threatened by the message of A Course in Miracles that its made-up world body is an illusion. The wrong
mind... Sound familiar?
Yeah, exactly. Wait a minute.
Hello, we're all there.
We're all there, you and everybody. It doesn't matter who... here's the thing. I think if we're walking on the earth, we're still believing this. And if we're not believing this, then we're actually walking on the earth. We are in control then of the illusion when we don't know this. I mean, when we do know this, because that's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
He walked in the dream without being in the dream. So, that is what he's telling us to do as well. So the wrong mind that is identified with the body feels threatened by the right mind that knows it is not a body. This conflict in the mind is the source of the depression and fear that you experience. They are the inevitable effects of the split mind that is in conflict over its identity and perceives itself as separate from its source. There is a part of the mind that knows it is wrong in identifying with the ego, but is enticed by the autonomy of specialness. Ooh, I like that. The autonomy of specialness. That's enticing, sure. And if you don't think it's enticing, then think about any situation in which your ability to choose for yourself has been taken away from you. And how angry, how upsetting, how fearful you become when you think, like you get thrown into jail. So for instance, I don't know if you've ever had that happen, get thrown into jail and all of a sudden you're on somebody else's turf and territory and you are no longer able to make the choice to walk out the door. So that makes you fearful and anxious, upset. Well, that's every bit of this illusion is doing that very same thing. And we're believing that but the jail cell is not locked. In fact, there's no bars. Those are all in our illusion, imaginary too. So the thing that we are imagining as our lovely home is actually our prison. But we think that that it's our choice. Mm-hmm. So,
When you asked the rhetorical question, you know, have you ever been in jail? And I was thinking, well, the last time I was in jail was playing Monopoly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is like a silly board game, but it's three dimensional, so it looks real. You know, I think I had a dog bite on my left leg when I was, you know, mm-hmm. 7 or 8, you know, up in the mountains, and I think that I was clearing up a pile of you know, limbs that I had in the yard with a chainsaw and nicked myself further down on that leg a few years later, and all these things in my story, you know, that are part of the massive help me ego identify with my body so that I can, you know, believe your hook, line, nonsense. And it's just silly. It's not evil, sinful, or wicked, like Ken says. It's just silly.
It's just silly. And, yeah. and when we do begin to see that as an illusion, it is terrifying. And that's why, you know, the whole idea, this last week we had the lesson. In fact, I think it was yesterday or day before, where if you start seeing little fringes of light around things, you know, and I know a lot of people that are like, oh, you know, I'm seeing fringes of light, or I'm seeing light, or light episodes, or, you know, he's not really even talking about what your vision with your eyes are.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. But I think actually in Absence from Felicity, Ken Wapnick goes into that particular lesson a little and says it was one of the few places it was an unfortunate choice of words, because people get so wrapped up in thinking that there's something physical about them, what that's stating, but it's not. Because if the Course is completely and only about the mind, then that is obviously a metaphor in the same context that, you know, God weeps for our return and all those kind of things. You know, it's like these are symbols of an aspect of ourselves that we use as symbolic, metaphoric reminders that we're not at home here. These flats put up by hypnosis are not at home. And I looked it up, by the way. It's El Mystico, not Magnifico. It's El Mystico. But I'll put the clip on the post when I get to it, because it's really a hoot. It's fun. Anyway, but we were, I think you were still.
And
that second paragraph. Yeah.
So he says, we were talking about the autonomy of specialness. I was just loving that phrase. The autonomy of specialness. This is a depressing and fearful condition because it rests precariously on the made-up belief that illusion is reality. The mind knows this belief can be as easily abandoned as it was chosen. Herein lies the cause of the predicament in which you find yourself, and its solution as well. The problem and the answer in the same exact place. What a concept. The problem has its source and its solution in the mind's ability to choose between the ego's belief in separation and the Holy Spirit's memory of the oneness with God that has never changed. The ego has us believe that somehow happiness is possible in the world, while the Holy Spirit reminds us that nothing but our oneness with each other and with God will make us happy. And so this is the conflict is between my oneness and my specialness, Yes. You know, which one of these is the one that is going to win? You know, which wolf will win? You know, that's not even a Cherokee story. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
No, yeah. That was made up by, actually, I think, Oral Roberts.
Oh, really?
It was, or no, maybe Billy Graham. It was some evangelist who put it was in a sermon that he gave. He made it up. Yeah. And it's been passed down as a Native American story ever since. But as are many of our myths and legends.
All twisted and distorted and modified and edited just to keep the game going, so that the game over doesn't flash across our minds and we wake up from ego's, you know, seemingly horrific, tyrannical, you know, terrifying dream, but it's just a silly dream.
It's just a silly dream. It's not really happening. So the ego has somehow made us believe that happiness is possible.
Yeah.
So that if I just get that brass ring, if I just win that lottery, if I just, you know, get that guy or get that girl or have that perfect child or get that job or climb that mountain or, you know, I mean, it's always something. You're always just reaching outside of yourself for whatever. And the fact is that there's nothing outside of you to reach for. You already have that. You already won the lottery. You already have the perfect mate. You already have these things because this is what you are. You're wholeness. We are wholeness. And the wholeness can't be incomplete in any way. So anything you in your mind that you think would be desirable or wonderful or beautiful or great to have, know that you already have that and much, much more and much, much better, just not able to see it because we're believing in this illusory, hypnotic hotel or condo.
The Hypno Hotel. I like that too. I'm going to use that. Yeah. Yeah. And as you're saying that, Lynn, I was thinking, you know, it's sort of like the Course in Forgiveness classroom is sort of like saying, what part of perfect oneness do I not want to understand? You know, because we obviously that's the resistance. That's it in a nutshell. You nailed it there. It's the fact that we don't want to accept the perfect oneness that we never left, because that would trigger the game over sequence. And we say, well, I'm having too much fun in this dream, you know?
Well, it's not even that. I'm anticipating in the future I'm going to have more fun. I'm not really having that much fun right now, and neither are you, and neither is the person the greatest sex and the greatest orgasm the person is having right this very moment is not enough.
Right, right. Oh, in fact, that reminds me of Jim Carrey's wonderful little clip on the Golden Globes Awards the other day, which I posted on Facebook, or shared, because somebody else shared it, and I just passed along, but like so many things else. But it basically, if you haven't seen it, basically, he's standing up to introduce another award, and all of course, anyway, his tux or whatever, and he's saying something that I'll have to, you know, be paraphrasing. Well, of course, I'm going to paraphrase again, but it was basically something to the effect of, "I'm not just when I fall asleep at night and I get tired. It's not just Jim Carrey falling asleep. It's Jim Carrey, two-time Golden Globe winner, falling asleep. And when I dream, I'm not just Jim Carrey dreaming. I'm Jim Carrey, two-time Golden Globe winner, dreaming that I can win that third Golden Globe award." He says, and then he says, "'Cause then I would be enough."
And that would be enough. Yep, exactly. That was great.
And it was such a great parody on the ego's seek but do not find paradigm. And I think it was just brilliant the way he did that. And he did it in a way that, you know, let everybody know that their ego is not off the hook, but what we really are is totally off the hook, you know. And because we could laugh at ourselves from above that battleground if we can look at ego's insane strategy of thinking, oh, it's this next health regimen, this, like you say, the lottery ticket, the perfect, you know, the physical state of our bodies, or our houses, or our cars, or our possessions, or our relationships, you know, if I just get enough of people liking me or friending me, or, you know, yada yada yada, the list goes on incessantly. It's just insane.
I had one this morning. This cracks me up so much. I was just laughing in the bathroom before I got, when I first got up, because yesterday my grand, you know, because I'm, you know, partially blind and you know, I can't see details that well, and you won't relate to this because you're a man and, you know, you don't get this stuff, I'm sure. But my eyebrows, I can't see to do my eyebrows. Now, you know, like I said, men don't really think too much about their eyebrows unless they're, you know, really unruly or something. But for women, somehow or the other, this idea of having the symmetrical, well, it has nothing to do with women. It has to do with an idea of symmetry that is genetically part of our disposition. But anyway, my granddaughter, who's 15, and she's like, she's an artist. She's like an eyebrow artist. So she came in and she did my eyebrows. And she, you know, she plucked them and trimmed them and filled them in and all this stuff, right? And so, you know, I was looking, so I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I was thinking, wow, you know, I look a lot younger with my eyebrows like that. And then starts this thing. Oh, you know what? You know, I can't see good enough to do my eyebrows like this every day, but you know what? I could go and get tattooed eyebrows. I could go and get my eyebrows tattooed on, and then I would always look like this. And I was like, is that the most insane things?
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually we all do it. It's not gender specific. I mean, if you extrapolate what you're just talking about, we're all trying to base our happiness on a tattoo, you know? But it's basically, you know, a facade or some kind of decoration that's going to change the intrinsic unsavoriness of the belief system that we've chosen, that seems to manifest in a specific form we call our bodies, in a specific world, in a specific planet, in a specific galaxy, and yada yada. But But that's just the mechanics of the mind's decision to choose against perfect oneness, thinking that we're able to pull that off. You know, that's just giving form to our desire, as the Course says. It's just fulfilling for us what we believe. And seen from above the battleground of this crazy dream, it's just like, oh, how silly for us to make such a big deal. But there's nothing wrong with doing that. I mean, I you know, shave, you know, at least every few days when I'm busy. And, you know, and I got a haircut the other day, and I went to the dentist a few weeks ago and got my teeth cleaned. You know, why wouldn't we do all those kind of normal things, right?
Right.
But
right.
At the same time, it's when we can look at our investment in all the bodily stuff, you know, whether it's an orgasm or trimming your fingernails or whether it's, you know, looking at your bank account and saying, oh, gee, I have, you know, just what I want. How many people say that, you know? But it's like Jim Carrey says, is it enough? Well, the ego is never enough, because the ego knows that it basically shut itself into a dream, thinking that it threw away the key, and now is terrified and trembling with sadness and fear that we believe that we actually pulled it off.
Yes.
But every time we go back to the shared interest, the inner kindness teacher's thought system, we get a little glimmer, a little bit of you know, radiance that fills our mind that says, oh yeah, I never left.
Never left. And the another thing that is really, really important in this particular paragraph here, the last sentence where he says, the Holy Spirit reminds us that nothing but our oneness with each other and with God will make us happy.
Yes.
And so, and when it comes right down to it, think about the times when you are in the greatest joy is when you are with and joining with another person or other persons,
yeah,
in whatever endeavor. When you are, you forget about time, you forget about your worries, you forget about, you know, you just get into being with people and having a joy, and then you long to have that happen. You know, this is why people get married. You know, oh, I want to have this joyful experience with this person, you know, forever and ever. But, you know, we don't recognize that by making it special like that, we've completely negated the ability to have that joyful experience, but we're still longing for it. And
right,
that's really what we long for, is the experience of oneness,
mm-hmm,
experiencing our connection. And what hurts us is that we spend so much of our lives rejecting that connection.
Right.
Looking at it, oh, well, your eyebrows aren't good enough, or, you know, you don't make enough money, or you don't smell good, or, you know, I don't like how you, I don't like your hair, Donald Trump, and I don't like what you say. You know, every time I think those kind of anything like that,
yeah,
I'm rejecting my own oneness.
Right. And it doesn't matter if it's the person that whose reflection we think we see in the mirror, or the person who we think we see on some other screen that's really, you know, a flat representation of a higher dimensional reality that is equally unreal. It doesn't matter, because it's all a dream state that we can turn around and use each of those reflections as our forgiveness curriculum, and that does make us happy. And it's not just a you know, a fleeting happiness. It's something that continues to build and accumulate, because it, in truth, we're not really building anything. We're just revealing what's already there, and we just see a larger amount of the iceberg of you know, we're diving down a little deeper and say, oh my gosh, there's a whole lot there. In fact, it's really the whole ocean, you know, but that metaphor sort of falls apart there. But, you know, it's the whole thing. It's really the unhappiness that's this thin, you know,
yeah,
negligible veneer that we've put over the true happiness that we have. But we don't know that until we start, you know, digging a little deeper and looking at the mind more consistently. So, shall I read the third paragraph?
Absolutely.
Okay. The world is brought into awareness and held together by the belief that happiness can be found in it. No one who comes here but must still have hope, some lingering illusion, or some dream that there is something outside himself, in brackets they put, outside the mind, that will bring happiness and peace to him. And that's from section 7, paragraph 2 in chapter 29 of the text, if anyone wants to look that up. In spite of all the evidence to the contrary, the ego insists there must be some way, just like we've been talking about, to keep the body, specialness, and the world, and still be happy. And it doesn't mean we discard them by going off and living in a cave or neglecting our responsibilities as we think of them in the world, to ourselves or to each other. To look at the investment that we have, the psychological and emotional attachment and specialness that we have around the specifics that we think are either making us happy or sad, you know, that we're the victim moment to moment, slammed against the rails, back and forth against, you know, these ephemeral emotions that don't work for us. Okay, and it continues. It seeks relentlessly to have its cake and eat it too. The fear and depression engendered by the split mind are further exacerbated by the fact that on some level we know this is impossible. Yeah, we know that the El Mystico's flats are not going to do it for us. They just waver too much, you know. We're starting to notice the wavering. And no matter how many times we, you know, hire him and, you know, get on the hotline and have him rush over to you know, restore the tipsy high-rise building that we think we live in, it's not cutting it. You know, it's just wavering too much. But that's a good thing. That's really a good thing, because maybe we'll just kind of leave that shabby abode and once and for all. And we know that that's ultimately what we're going to do, and have the real palatial mindscape that we really belong in and never left. Yeah. Okay. I'll start that sentence over. Thus, the underlying every pursuit of specialness is inescapable sense of futility. Each quest ends in bitter disappointment and loss. For no matter how deceptively satisfying love seems to be, it cannot last. And yeah, whether it's a lottery ticket or an orgasm or a new job or a new car or a kid at Christmas with the new toy, and you know, next a few hours or days later, they're playing with the box, and then it gets torn and that's discarded too. You know, it's not going to last. But you know, knock ourselves out. Nobody is. And that's a thing I really like, that you know, the course is incredibly authoritative, but not authoritarian, and it's gentle. It's very, very firm, but it's very gentle because it doesn't demand anything of us. It basically says, whenever you're ready, this is an idea that you will, in some form or another, maybe not in this form, you know, maybe it's some other non-dual tradition or some, you know, thing you've just figured out on your own. Seemingly, but it's all the same ideas, that we've never left that oneness, and we never left each other. I like, yeah, like how that last sentence in the previous paragraphs is our oneness with each other and with God that will make us happy. Yeah, and that's where the shared interest, I think, comes in. Okay, and then this last sentence in the third paragraph. And since we are told that only what is lasting can be real, and only what is real can bring us happiness, the ego's maxim, seek but do not find, is fulfilled. So that's the ego's whole strategy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the seek find thing, you know, when I first read that, I was like, well, I don't even really get what that means. Mm-hmm. But then I started seeing and living the examples of it. And this is something too. I think a lot of folks, you know, when we first start studying the course, we can only see it on it. For me, I felt it on a very deep level, but I understood it on a very superficial and intellectual, conceptual level. And you know, I think a lot of times folks get caught up in that intellectual, conceptual, and don't get into the actual experience of the lesson. And so, when I started, you know, when I was seeing this, you know, what is it that he's telling me that all of these things are caused by this idea that I'm a split mind, that I'm not, I'm not connected to my source, and that wherever I look for peace, I'm not going to find it because it's not here. And really, that's the main, you know, the ego's, you know, seek but do not find, really is because seek all you want, you'll never find it because it's not here.
Right,
and it never
right.
will be, because it is not something that can be conceptualized or understood. It is only something that can be known and felt. And so, and because of our particular Western mindset, we have been taught from the very beginning to be suspicious of feeling and to be confident of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so, and this is why this course is the way it is. If in the Eastern world, and I'm not, you know, this is a blanket statement, obviously it doesn't have any more truth than anything else, but you know, people are brought up with a different kind of concept or cosmology of, you know, what the world, the universe is. And, you know, people say, well, you know, I can't teach my child A Course in Miracles because how can you tell a little child that the world is not real? Well, go to India and ask those people how they're telling their children that the world is not real, because that's a basic tenet of the major spiritual belief in India. So anyway, I digress. I get a little heated up about this kind of stuff, actually, because, you know, we're all capable of knowing and understanding this truth, but we're also the primary thing is that we're capable of knowing it in our hearts, but we can't, in this, where we've been brought up to be so intellectual and so trusting of the world and suspicious of the spirit and the heart, that the course was made to soften that up, to break up that dependence on the mind. And that's why Jesus insults us so often in our, you know, insults our intellect, insults our, you know, like, you know, this is, you know, you're carrying around something shabby and touting it as being gold, you know, the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. It's insulting. But when you get past that bridling at the insult and start reaching into your heart and how you actually are feeling. And this is, you know, when Jesus says, how do you know if this is working? How do you feel?
Yeah.
That's really why you have to get into, is how does it make me feel? And then I can, it's very easy to tell when the ego is flaring up. It's very easy to tell when I'm listening to spirit. And it's very easy to tell that I'm seeking for something that I'm not going to find, because I feel the fear, the nervous anxiety, the, you know, all those feelings that are there as signals to me of, you know, my own misthinking. So, you know, not to belabor that, but this is why we have this classroom. See, this is why this world has been turned into a classroom, so that we can get out of the thinking and into the feeling by, you know, all these things he's teaching us to do. So the last paragraph of this section, he says, the world will not disappear from awareness as long as we want it. And that there, right there, is, that's damning. Because it just says, if it's here, I want it. You know, it's here because I want it. I can't say I don't want it anymore, because right, obviously I do, or else I wouldn't be here. So in this regard, Jesus tells us, fear not that you will be abruptly lifted up and hurled into reality. Time is kind, and if you use it on behalf of reality, it will keep gentle pace with you in your transition. And this brings to mind, and I'm going to stop here and let you talk, because I have a feeling you have something to say. But this brings to mind people who say that they've been enlightened and they didn't really know anything about it. They weren't planning on it. They have no idea what it is or how it came to them. They were just suddenly enlightened, and now they're, you know, there is some great wise soul with some great understanding of things, and yet they still believe they're in the world. They still worry about their paycheck. They're still concerned about, you know, how many speaking engagements or how many books they write, or, and I'm not saying not every one of them. I'm just saying that, you know, these people that pop up that are all of a sudden enlightened out of anywhere, I don't particularly believe it, because Jesus just told me right here that he would never do that to us. And so they must be experiencing something. I know, I'm sure they're experiencing something, but being hurled into reality is not one of them. anyway.
Yeah, I first I want to acknowledge what you were saying about feeling, because that's so important, and it reminded me of a section in the I think it was the fifth stage of trust in the development of trust in the manual for teachers, where I was just reading that last night this would be difficult indeed if each step were not so heavily reinforced. I think something to that effect, and I love that concluding sentence in that section, because it would be difficult if it's not so heavily reinforced. Well, the reinforcement is, like you say, the feeling. We feel everything, and not the feeling in terms of the ego's sloppy, sentimental, incredibly unmindful, indulgence in self-pity and victimhood, and not that kind of feeling, but the feeling that says, I'm not at home here. I'm not in this state of mind that is the ego's domain. It couldn't possibly fulfill me, and so therefore it is not my reality. But the reality that we never left is that's why it's so challenging, because we have made this artificial wall in our minds to reality that seems so real, and we need to brick by brick dismantle it, and that's where the forgiveness comes in, to forgive ourselves for doing that, but that we get that classroom moment to moment with all the things that pop up in front of our face, and it does keep gentle pace with us in our transition, because we get to little by little look at our investment and just say, we're not being forced to do anything, we're just given an opportunity with this thought system that we all have to choose again, to seek something different, seek the real alternative. Yeah. Should we finish off that paragraph?
Yeah, and I just was going to say, the way that you get those prompts, those feelings, those suddenly joy just springs up in me. Sometimes I'm just sitting, just sitting, and all of a sudden I just say, I am so happy, people don't just say I'm so happy out of nowhere. It's you get this, and that you're it's something from within that is just here to just help you be comfortable in your decision, help you to be comfortable in your thinking, whatever. Let's see, where do we go? Okay, so so you will not be hurled into reality. Keeping these comforting words in mind while working with the Course will not only lessen the fear that impedes progress, but do much to relieve the distress you describe. The pace is gentle because we are not forced to accept anything for which we're not ready. In his curriculum of forgiveness, the Holy Spirit respects our belief that the world is real. In fact, he uses the world as a classroom to teach us to forgive ourselves for taking the tiny mad idea of separation seriously. Thus chosen by the ego as a place to hide and forget God, the world can be used by the Holy Spirit to remember God and return to the home we never left. Therefore, release from depression in the face of the illusory nature of the world is found in changing the world's purpose from the ego's goal to the Holy Spirit's. The world itself then becomes an opportunity to find our way out of it through forgiveness. So using the old thorn to remove the thorn.
Yeah.
Good one. The needle to take out the splinter. Mm-hmm. Forget not that the healing of God's Son is all the world is for. That is the only purpose the Holy Spirit sees in it, and thus the only one it has. And that's from chapter 24. And that's it. What is the purpose? And if you come to the place where you're really questioning, is this the real world? Is it a fantasy? I'll sing you this morning, I guess. But but when you come to the point where you're asking that question, there are, you know, he says angels, and another place in the Manual for Teachers, he says that those who have come to be to see God or to know God have become like mentors in the spirit world, and they can appear to us and help us, and that we should call on them, and they know who we are. You know, I don't hear a lot of Course in Miracles teachers telling people to do that, but it sure is something that Jesus says can be done, and that is being offered freely, and that if we were had any sense in our heads, we would be doing that. But
since you mentioned that, I think that's a good example of how we can literally generalize by taking everything that seems to happen to us and turn it around, realizing it's coming from us. And then symbolically, the demons that seem to plague us become the angels, again, symbolically. Not that they're special, because everyone and everything becomes that angelic messenger of forgiveness. Everything and everyone becomes an opportunity to choose once again, and to choose the thought system of kindness, and to realize that, you know, we didn't leave heaven. We're not in this tottering, high-rise, dilapidated slum of the ego's thought system, and we never left. It's all good.
Yep, it's all good. We never left. And I posted that on the board. Dances was asking to say that again about the. I'm just going to read this from the Manual for Teachers real quick. It says, there are those who have reached God directly, retaining no trace of worldly limits and remembering their own identity perfectly. Those might be called the teachers of teachers. And see, he's saying these people exist. He's not saying, well, it could be possible. He's saying there are people, there are those who have done this, and they are teachers of teachers. Although they are no longer visible, their image can be called upon, and they will appear when and where it is helpful for them to do so. To those to whom such appearances would be frightening, they give their ideas. No one can call on them in vain, nor is there anyone of whom they are unaware. All needs are known to them, and all mistakes are recognized and overlooked by them. The time will come when this is understood, and meanwhile, they give all their gifts to the teachers of God, who look to them for help, asking all things in their name and in no other. So, you know, here's a promise that there are, you know, mighty companions who are just waiting for us to ask for help. And they're here to help us. So, so anyway, I find that just pretty amazing. And again, you know, why people, you know, in the Course world don't really talk about this. There's several places where he mentions these kinds of things. And it just opens up a more, you know, I'm recognizing that all these things that, you know, I just thought were, fantasies,
yeah,
really are true, really, really are true. So anyway, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Lynn.
This time with you, so much fun going
on
the world.
It is, because I think it's really helpful, because we get to remind ourselves, seemingly, and in a way that it might be helpful to others, that it seemed to be others, but remind ourselves that the others are ourselves, and that's our ticket home, isn't it?
Exactly. So God bless you, Bruce, and
likewise.
I'm going to let you go, and we're going to do a Sikh meditation. So time for our morning meditation, and we're going to do some chanting. So talk to you next week, my brother, and I'll send you this recording.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.